you know, you have these dry counties, but the counties that are not dry, capitalists are going to capitalist. They're going to put a store right on the edge of the new county. We should.
I would love to know, like, if they don't have the vice of alcohol, of drinking, are there other vices that pop up? Do they do other things in places like that? I wonder.
I wonder. I was about to say, we should do a story on the different alcohol cultures across the country or across, you know. So anyway, we'll continue to follow the story.
Thanks for listening to Noise Filter, your public health podcast. Stay well out there, folks, and continue taking steps to keep yourself and your loved ones healthy. That includes exercise, a good diet, getting adequate sleep, and seeing your healthcare providers regularly.
And protect yourself and others by getting the COVID-19 vaccine and booster, wearing a mask, and social distancing wherever possible. Remember, health is a human right.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, starting Friday, February 3rd, until Saturday, March 4th. Screenings will take place every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, bringing live interviews with filmmakers, community conversations, and more. Films will be screened at PCC Cascade, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org. That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening throughout the month of February in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think the ask isn't that we have more ESG, but that we have more standardization of reporting around this, and that companies actually think and evaluate what their products are doing to the world. So while we're talking about the Republican end goal here, it's important to think about what the other side's end goal really is, and what climate activists are really asking for isn't this world where we all have ESG. It's that we actually truly assess climate change and its impacts in Wall Street and its investments.
Environmental, social, and corporate governance, referred to as ESG, is a set of factors that conscientious capitalists use to identify worthy investments. For most of the movement's relatively brief existence, ESG has fallen under the purview of sustainability experts. Recently, however, Wall Street appears to have embraced ESG with both arms. According to some estimates, last year over $41 trillion in global ESG assets were traded. This turn has liberals and environmentalists concerned that the definition of what qualifies as an ESG-friendly company may be watered down. At the same time, prominent Republicans are decrying the use of ESG factors, claiming that it's part of the woke mob's war on fossil fuels. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Rebecca Lieber, a senior climate reporter at Vox. She unpacks the complex conservative position on the ESG movement and explains why she finds it so puzzling and troubling.
Uptown, it's murder out in the street. dream.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rebecca Lieber. Rebecca is a senior climate reporter at Vox. Rebecca, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be back on.
So to kick off the new year, I wanted you to walk our listeners through this piece that you wrote in December of 2022 entitled The Weird Republican Turn Against Corporate Social Responsibility. And it is a strange little twist. Why don't you kind of outline what the Republican beef is with corporate social responsibility measures, or ESG, that stands for environment, social, governance. A lot of people on the left, they've been critical of ESG not going far enough, but the Republicans think it's too far. Why don't you explain what kind of ripples they're sending through Congress?
Yeah, this is a complicated issue that goes back a bit, so I'll do my best here to lay it out. But the reason the headline of the story calls this weird is because for all the experts I talked to and onlookers, even people in the financial community, they're just baffled by what's going on here, because the GOP is basically holding up this version of ESG that doesn't really exist. It's a complete misunderstanding of what's actually happening in the financial world. So the first thing to remember about this fight is it's a political one, not so much an economic division in the financial community. So like you said, ESG stands for environmental social governance. And it's basically a framework that applies to how companies evaluate the risks of a whole set of issues that range from climate change to corporate transparency to human rights violations in countries that they might operate in. And they're evaluating the risks that this posed to the company's bottom line. So it's basically this recognition of a reality that's out there that's not normally taken into account in a company's typical earnings and its typical reports. So going back actually decades now, lots of onlookers, including the UN Secretary General in 2004, challenged the corporate community to finally acknowledge all of these other risks that they're not incorporating into their planning for the future. So that's where ESG comes in. It's not specifically just a climate issue. It applies to a range of things. But also, if this sounds really vague, it's because it is. It's vague by design. ESG is this catch-all phrase that's been used for all these kinds of issues. And it doesn't mean a company is required to do anything particularly different in the present. It's all looking at future bottom lines, future investing decisions. What the GOP is presenting this as is a dangerous kind of concept taking over the business community that discriminates against fossil fuels. There's this argument circulating among the critics of ESG that this is basically an attempt at collusion by environmentalists, by companies to stop fossil fuels and to move towards this climate future. On the other side of this are actually environmentalists who also don't like ESG for very different reasons, because it is used as this catch-all that tends to greenwash corporate actions. So we'll dig into this more, because this is quite complicated to explain, but because it's such a vague concept, it becomes this kind of projection of what its critics want it to be. And that's what the GOP is taking advantage of here.
And maybe that's one of the problems with ESG, is that it is so vague that it can be whatever you want it to be. So the Republicans, we could look at it as saying they're misunderstanding it, but maybe they're understanding it perfectly and exploiting the vagaries of ESG. I read a quote in your piece from West Virginia's Treasurer Riley Moore saying, quote, "You're talking about climate change, you know, in 100 years. I mean, these folks are hedging on what climate might look like in 100 years. And he goes on to say, "So what you're telling me is you're going to have sea levels rise by X amount of centimeters in 100 years, and that somehow is going to affect the profitability of a company? Not sure I follow that." So he's being intentionally obtuse, and it seems to be kind of a way to muddy the waters, if you will.
I think Riley Moore's quote hints at a driving factor for basically why Republicans would attack you'd think they're their own allies. And this undercurrent of climate change denial and this fear that the financial world is actually realigning with climate science. If you look at this long arc of how Republicans have messaged on climate change over the years, they've cycled through lots of different excuses for not taking action. But there's lots of polls that show how the public has embraced climate science. People tend to agree that climate change is a threat. So the Republicans basically outright denying it is no longer really politically viable. But what they may be doing here is finding another boogeyman, which is corporate wokeism. So Moore's quote here really just gets at that point, because what he is presenting is a skepticism about the science, but camouflaging this as this is a fight over how this affects consumers, how this affects pensioners. I think what the GOP is responding to here is this growing recognition from Wall Street that climate change is a threat and that they can't willfully be blind to the risk that it imposes. This is, we've seen over the years, lots of forward movement in boardrooms and in Wall Street. I think most critical, BlackRock came out in 2021 talking very strongly about climate change and how it needs to incorporate climate risks in its assessments. At the same time, lots of oil companies have seen challenges at their own annual shareholder meetings pushing for certain climate reforms. So the train's already left the station essentially for Wall Street. And this is, I think, one way Republicans are trying to take back this and go on the offense over an issue that they really can't find a politically winning platform point on.
Yeah, they've decided this is a new social wedge issue. I saw that Florida in September banned its $186 billion pension fund from investing according to ESG factors. So this is kind of the backlash of seeing Wall Street slowly but surely come along and say, yes, we need to be taking in these existential threats to the planet into our balance sheets and into how we invest in companies. And now the right is basically framing it as they're just being politically correct.
Yeah, I think an important point, just to frame how big of a deal this is blue states actually far outweigh investments and political capital in companies like BlackRock than red states have. So basically, when you look at what West Virginia has done, what Florida has done, and states like it, this is a drop in the bucket for a company like BlackRock that has trillions of dollars globally. But the politics still matter here. So while the actual withdrawals of funding and the divestment won't really make a difference in terms of BlackRock's planning, because it won't affect its bottom line politically, I think companies, we've seen them either try to moderate their positions or walk back certain efforts. So the biggest news was Vanguard withdrawing from a net zero coalition after it was called into hearings in Texas around ESG. So it's important to remember the scope, that it's not clear that these Republican attacks are really going to work, because the financial numbers just aren't in favor of them. But politically, there is signs this is scaring the big companies. So I think 2023 is going to really be a big year for this, where we see how much damage these kinds of investigations, this divestment, can really do. Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east too far. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. On the oceans and upon high seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, fish full of
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Rebecca Lieber. She's a senior climate reporter at Vox. So, Rebecca, we're talking about the Republican attacks on ESG, corporate social responsibility guidelines for companies, investors. And what are kind of the barometers for whether this works? Is this more of a political gambit where they're trying to turn this into a social wedge issue like gays, guns, and God type thing? Or is this more of a way to threaten corporate America from looking at the realities of climate science?
There are some limitations to this really becoming a huge popular issue. Just look at this. We took a few minutes just to lay out what ESG was and to explain all of the nuance here.
Yes, and we've done so many pieces on ESG, and it was called CSR. Each time we have to spend 5 minutes kind of recapping what it is, because it is a little too in the weeds for mom and pop kind of explanations. Sorry to interrupt, go on.
Yeah, it's an in the weeds issue for me too. So I think right there that tells you a lot about the limitations of this becoming a huge electoral issue. I haven't really seen any signs there. This was kind of floated in the midterms as a issue Republicans were trying to campaign on. And I'm not sure we saw any real signs of this gaining traction. I think the most high profile example has been DeSantis in Florida, who has been really outspoken on this. So maybe he's testing the waters if this does work in a presidential run. But I think this is really limited politically in terms of getting votes. So I'm not sure how much traction it's really going to get there.
Just thinking of DeSantis in a presidential run, you could see him trying to align with some of the deeper pocketed forces in Wall Street that would say, yeah, enough of this ESG crap. We're going to go with this guy, DeSantis, who is calling it like it is and trying to bring us back to the good old days of 1974 or whatever.
Yeah, he's clearly trying certain tactics to distinguish himself from Trump. But I think the end game isn't really a political one here in terms of winning the presidential election. I think there are different end games here. Some we talked about, I think this is a backlash to the recognition by Wall Street that climate change is real. It's also kind of this recasting of corporate America as somehow aligned with the left. This is a populist issue to say that the GOP is taking on Wall Street in a way that traditionally we wouldn't expect Republican leaders to. So there is a bit of that clever messaging there where environmentalists are put in a difficult position here specifically because they don't want to be defending BlackRock here. They are also critical of BlackRock. So there's some clever politics here. It's a warning sign, or they're trying to warn off companies from taking further action on climate change. So there are real policy stakes here, and there are real world economic stakes for people who live in red states, because states that have been pulling pensions from some of these companies in the long run, it's unclear how this is going to affect pensions, because some financial experts told me how if states continue to divest from the companies that are considering climate change, they might be exposing pensioners to a lot more risk in the market because they are far less diversified. We might see a scenario where we have this polarized world of banks, of red banks versus blue banks. And there's other ways that states can do damage because there's other arms that they are trying to test out with this strategy. So I just want to remind folks that even if politically this might not gain a ton of traction with voters, it has some real world stakes.
I'm just trying to think from the Republican strategy standpoint why this might work. They're trying to thread this needle where rhetorically they're taking on Wall Street, but they're protecting fossil fuel interests, which are part of Wall Street. So that maybe that's part of the weirdness that we're looking at in your piece, is that they're trying to have their cake and eat it too, but maybe it'll work.
Yeah, there are lots of links to the far right plank of Republican parties, the groups that have really propelled this issue. Lots of them are connected to the Federalist Society's Leonard Leo. And there's a whole series of dark money funded groups that have been pushing this message around ESG. Lots of these groups are known to have to be funded by the oil industry and by fossil fuels, though we don't know to the exact extent because they're dark money. So this connects back to our basic fights around climate change. But I just wanted to add, because again, I don't want to sing the praises of ESG too much because it has lots of limitations. There are ESG funds that include ExxonMobil in them, and that's because the company does disclose some of its risks from climate change, and it also meets certain requirements on corporate transparency. So just to be clear, I think the ask isn't that we have more ESG, but that we have more standardization of reporting around this, and that companies actually think and evaluate what their products are doing to the world. So while we're talking about the Republican end goal here, it's important to think about what the other side's end goal really is and what climate activists are really asking for. Isn't this world where we all have ESG, it's that we actually truly assess climate change and its impacts in Wall Street and its investments.
Don't go near the water, children. See the fish all dead upon the shore. Don't go near the water, cause the water isn't water anymore. From the fountains and the mountains comes the water running cool and clear and blue. And it comes down from the hills, and it goes down to the towns and passes through. When it gets down to the cities, then the water turns into a dirty gray. Cause it's poisoned and polluted by the people as it goes along its way. Don't go near the water, children. See the fish.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to senior climate reporter at Vox, Rebecca Lieber. So, Rebecca, we were talking about the impact that the right's attack on ESG, environment, social governance guidelines, will have on the movement. Let's look at some of the shortcomings. You mentioned some of them from the left that's saying that ESG factors are becoming, maybe the standards are dropping so much. That could be one of the reasons why it's so wildly popular as an investment barometer or tranche. I think some reports say that global ESG assets total around $41 trillion this last year. And that's a huge explosion. But maybe some of that is because the barriers for entry are lower. Like you mentioned, a fossil fuel company can get in if they have good corporate transparency or they do have an active recycling program, irrespective of the fact that their main product is choking the planet. So do you think that maybe the right's attack on ESG could damage some of the progress that's being made from the left in criticizing it and forcing the left and environmentalists to back this flawed system?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really tricky situation. And at the time that I was reporting this piece, I think what I sensed was that environmentalists who've worked on this issue and made some real progress on their aims have been a bit caught off guard by how quickly this anti-ESG backlash has grown in the States. I think one limitation is like I said, the messaging on this is pretty tricky, that no one really wants to come out and defend BlackRock here. So I think there are some impacts. So one that I mentioned was a big development was right ahead of a Texas hearing around ESG, where they hauled in companies including State Street, Vanguard, and BlackRock. Vanguard actually announced it was withdrawing from a global net zero coalition. And once it announced that, the Texas Republicans actually, they dropped them from the hearing. They were no longer asked to testify. And that was seen as this very clear concession that Vanguard was making to say stop looking at us. We don't want the scrutiny. So while that net zero pledge, there's plenty of criticism to make that this is, that net zero pledge wasn't doing a ton in the first place. I think it puts climate activists in this precarious position because they were running this campaign unopposed for years, and they were winning because the science is in their favor and the financial numbers are also in their favor here. But now with this pretty effective backlash that's taking states over, next year we're going to see bills in at least 15 states around this anti-ESG legislation. Now that climate activists are facing this kind of backlash, I think corporations are put in this weird position too, where they are essentially going to have to pick which direction they're going into. Are they going to appease Republicans, or are they going to forge ahead with what the science says and with what progressive activists are pressuring them to do? So I think it forces more of a crossroads than we would have seen without this.
The fossil fuel divestment movement, is that at all related to the anti-ESG backlash by the GOP? Is the fossil fuel divestment campaign led by organizations like 350.org, Bill McKibben's co-founder of that organization and has been a real vocal leader in that divestment space? I mean, you're having large elite university funds, pension funds, et cetera, working to eliminate fossil fuels from their portfolios. Is this completely separate issue, or is it related?
I think it's related in a few ways. One is, I think the divestment movement was a precursor to all this. It has been wildly successful and goes back about a decade, long before environmentalists saw any gains in the boardroom. I think the strategies are slightly different because divestment is arguing that institutions should pull out funds from fossil fuels, while I think the ESG movement is a little bit more inside baseball. It's working inside the corporate boardroom, pushing shareholder resolutions at the annual meetings, all in order to get companies to recognize this future. So I think there's a slight distinction here, but they do overlap. But there's another similarity here. And one of the criticisms of the divestment movement is that lots of people have wondered, how effective is it really? Because again, if you look at what institutions have invested in fossil fuels, it's a drop in the bucket for a company like Exxon. And one argument in favor of divestment was it was more of a political campaign to ostracize fossil fuel companies rather than hurt them financially. This is, I think, an important lesson from divestment that applies to what the GOP is doing, because in some cases, Republican state treasurers are also arguing to divest in a very different way. They're not arguing to divest from fossil fuel companies, but they're arguing they are pulling funds from companies that are evaluating the future of fossil fuel companies and also overtly supporting oil, gas, and coal. So I think it also offers a lesson of, when we think about what the impact of what red states are doing, is that it's going to be pretty limited, because divestment itself is a really hard strategy to pull off in an economic sense, and it is more a political one that works to ostracize and make a political point.
So now that we have a GOP-controlled House of Representatives, is there anything on the docket right now that speaks to what we're talking about here in terms of the Republican attack on ESG parameters?
The short answer is yes. Republicans have already promised this will come, where they will haul in companies and request documents in order to prepare antitrust investigations around this issue. I think the major way this is going to manifest this year is in investigations, because we do have a split Congress. So that's where I would watch. And there's a lot more damage I think Republicans could do at the state level, where they do have control. So investigations at the federal level and trying to stall various rules, like what the SEC is undertaking around ESG disclosure. And then at the state level, we're going to see more bills that divest funds and limit what banks that states can use for their own projects. So it's going to be a dual approach.
Rebecca Lieber, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Donald Fagan, Marvin Gaye, and Johnny Cash. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
Hi, this is Pat Matheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now.
Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. The 2023 Oregon Legislature is in session, and my guest is Zach Winston, Policy Director with Oregon Justice Resource Center. We'll talk about their 2023 legislative agenda, which includes the right to vote, compassionate medical release, and justice for survivor defendants. Welcome, Zach.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Zach, the 2023 Oregon legislative session has begun, and we're off to a quick start. So let's start with Senate Bill 579.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely off to a fast start, and 579 is probably off to the fastest start of our bills. And so Senate Bill 579 is our Guaranteeing the Right to Vote bill. Chief sponsors are Senator Pazansky, Senator Gelser Bluin, Senator Dembro, Senator Jama, and Senator Manning Jr. And so Senator Pazansky has introduced the bill for us. And what this bill does, and listeners may remember this from prior sessions, this is our third time around on this bill. It's incredibly important, so we're going to keep bringing it. And I think this session really does have a good shot of passing. So we believe at OJRC that all Oregonians should have a say in what happens in their community and a voice in their government. So the right to vote is enshrined in our Constitution, fundamental to a vibrant and participatory democracy. But many incarcerated Oregonians are currently denied the right to vote, which leads to low-income, Black, Indigenous, and people of color being disproportionately disenfranchised by the system. And so Oregon must guarantee the right to vote for people impacted by the criminal legal system. Essentially what SB 579 would do, and SB is shorthand for Senate Bill, it will ensure that every incarcerated Oregonian who is a U.S. citizen can register to vote, update their voter registration, and vote in elections based on where they resided prior to their incarceration. And that's an important piece, and happy to go into that more. But that's kind of the basic of the bill. It'll also ensure that adults in custody receive the same voter information that we receive in the general community. So voter pamphlets, for example, would go to adults in custody so they can cast informed votes. And so we believe that guaranteeing the right to vote addresses significant racial inequities, fulfills the promise of our democracy, and it actually does improve public safety and community well-being for everyone. And so I think the exciting news on this is we received a public hearing on January 26th in the Senate Judiciary, and we had over 150 written comments in support of the bill, which is just an astonishing number, especially on such short notice. And we have a work session that has been scheduled, and we'll see where that goes. But we're hoping to have the bill passed out of Senate Judiciary.
So you say it improves public safety, and there's also a claim that it reduces or lowers the rates of recidivism. How so?
I mean, we know that 95% of people in prison, roughly, will be returning to their communities. And we know that study after study has shown that successful reentry greatly reduces the likelihood of people returning to prison. And so that includes ensuring people can become engaged and active in their communities. And so that's what this bill does. Guaranteeing the right to vote keeps people involved, adults in custody involved while they're in prison, and keeps them involved with their communities, and therefore makes our communities safer because they stand a better chance of reentering successfully if they stay connected to their community. And that's why it's so important that the voting registration address is the last voluntary address. And so that hopefully ensures that the individual can stay connected with their community. And I think the important piece here is I'm formerly incarcerated myself, but also our entire policy team is formerly incarcerated at the Oregon Justice Resource Center. And we actually have about, I think, 25% of our staff right now are formerly incarcerated. And so I think when it's a really good group to get together and talk about how we believe this bill will impact the formerly and currently incarcerated population. And I think there is an overwhelming belief and just knowledge that the more you isolate individuals while they're incarcerated, the worse they're going to do upon reentry, the worse they're going to do inside, you know, while they're incarcerated, but also when they're trying to reenter successfully. And so I think that we understand that keeping people engaged while they're incarcerated, allowing them to vote, keeping them connected to their communities, voting in, for example, school board races, right? People who are incarcerated still have family who are not incarcerated, who are living in their communities. You know, a parent should have the ability to vote in a school board election that will impact their child. And so we do believe that this will reduce recidivism. There are studies out there that show that those who vote upon reentering stand a better chance and have a lower recidivism rates than those who don't vote.
Do Oregonians who are incarcerated want this right? And I understand they do hold mock elections at the Oregon State Penitentiary. Talk about that.
They do. And so I mentioned that I'm formerly incarcerated. I wasn't incarcerated in Oregon. And so I actually wasn't familiar with the mock elections. But this is the great thing about having a wealth of knowledge on our policy team and at OJRC of those who are formerly incarcerated in Oregon, who mentioned that they have mock elections for the presidential elections, I think dating back to the 90s, maybe, if I remember correctly. And then they also hold elections for clubs as well. So they have these mock elections where I believe Anthony Pickens, who's on OJRC staff, I think he mentioned that there was about a 70% turnout rate for the mock election vote. And so this is, again, this is a vote that doesn't actually impact technically anything in terms of the elections. And yet you still have 70% of those who can vote voting in this mock election. And so, you know, adults in custody are trying to get involved as much as they can. It's very hard to get them involved in the legislative process because the Department of Corrections logistically makes that difficult. But our formerly incarcerated population is really trying to lift up and really center the currently incarcerated individuals. And so our hope is to have to turn out a lot of different testimony from those who are currently incarcerated. With 579, our coalition has support of over 40 civil rights, faith-based, and community-based organizations, as well as dozens of currently and formerly incarcerated people. There is a desire for individuals who are incarcerated to vote.
And Oregon does allow formerly incarcerated people, as they do release from prison, and while they're on post-supervision, they can vote. So can you talk about the current laws?
Sure. So that's correct. So the when you are released from prison in Oregon, you can vote. And maybe I'll circle back around to the misinformation that makes that difficult to actually fulfill. But currently, the way it stands in Oregon is that if you are incarcerated pretrial, so in county jail pretrial, or if you are incarcerated in county jail on a misdemeanor conviction, so not a felony conviction, you are allowed to vote. Now, whether that's happening in practice, that's another area that we're trying to work on, which is implementation of voting in jail, which should be allowed, but I think is woefully lacking. Now, if you're incarcerated in jail on a felony conviction, you are not allowed to vote. And then I think the distinctions get even more difficult when you get into the Oregon Youth Authority, who can and can't vote there. And so I think one of the ideas behind this bill is really it will simplify the question of who can vote in Oregon related to the criminal legal system. And the answer will be everyone. You never lose your right to vote. And I think this goes to the misinformation that's out there, because news has been so nationalized that when you have Twitter being, for example, the distributing all this news from around the country, what happens is you have individuals who hear stories out of, let's say, Florida, which has significant problems right now with the way that they're implementing what the voters voted for, which was to allow those with felony convictions to vote, and now are arresting people for doing so. And so when Oregonians hear that, formerly incarcerated Oregonians hear that, you know, it makes sense that they're scared about potentially voting. And so I think that that's one of the big concerns, is that it's really hard with the nuances involved to say who can and can't vote. The messaging on it is relatively nuanced. And if you're erring on the side of caution and being risk adverse, which you know, many of those of us who are reentering often do, then you're just going to say, I'm not going to vote. And I think that that's what's really another really important piece of this bill, which is that the messaging on this is going to be, you never lose your right. You can always vote. All you have to do is register. And if you're already registered, just change your mailing address. That's hopefully a simpler message.
You mentioned that people incarcerated will be able to vote in elections based on where they resided prior to their incarceration. So talk about that and talk about how this would work once passed.
So once passed, I think the simplest way to put it is that when someone is registering, let's say that they are, you know, Coffee Creek is the intake facility, and then it's also the women's facility. And so the idea would be that, first off, if we can implement better processes in the county jails, then people will already be registered to vote by the time they get to the Department of Corrections and to prison, and they can just update their mailing address. But that's a perfect world and something we're going to be working on in implementation. But if that doesn't get stood up as quickly as we would like, then when someone comes into the Department of Corrections at Coffee Creek, for example, our hope is that they are provided access to, amongst all the other forms that they're provided access to, a voter registration form. And then they will list their last voluntary address as their voter registration address, and then they will list Coffee Creek as their mailing address. Now, the one thing that we have to remember is that if someone gets moved from Coffee Creek to another facility, there will have to be access to a voter registration form to update the mailing address. But so that's really the piece of the puzzle, is that as long as the form's available, individuals can register and then also update their mailing address. But the real reason behind last voluntary address is to keep that connection to community. The only other option is to have individuals voting where they're incarcerated, which oftentimes, as I think a lot of your listeners know, is Eastern Oregon. So like outside the I-5 corridor, which is where the majority of the population lives, and individuals are being sent to Eastern Oregon to prison. And so the idea is that if they're voting with their last voluntary address, they're staying connected to that community, and that's likely where they're going to be going back to when they're released. And so that's the connection that we'd like to keep.
All right, let's move on to Senate Bill 520, which is the compassionate medical release. Can you talk about that bill? We've been here before.
We have been here before on this as well. And now this is as simple as SB 579 is. SB 520 definitely has some more intricacies to it. So we are calling it, it's a compassionate medical release or early medical release. They're somewhat interchangeable. And this is again, Senator Dembro bringing the bill. We're working on the third year again, or third session. And the bill, interestingly, just for those who are tracking where these bills are in the legislature, is in Senate Healthcare Committee, which is different. The previous two sessions, we've been in Judiciary Committee. And so we'll see what that brings for us, but we're excited to be educating additional lawmakers on this bill in that committee. So we know Oregon has a growing population of aging adults who are in custody, and they struggle with basic daily activities. So eating, drinking, dressing, walking, bathing themselves is difficult due to poor health. And Oregon has already concluded that we don't need to keep incarcerating these individuals, right? We have a current compassionate release process. The issue is that the process doesn't work. So the current process is opaque and confusing. Timelines are too drawn out. The method of review isn't medically informed, right? It's the Board of Parole making medical decisions, and they don't have any medical professionals on the Board of Parole. And what we have heard anecdotally and what we've seen in the numbers is that most eligible people just fail to navigate it. It's just not possible. And we've actually seen that more individuals have died awaiting compassionate release, their application for compassionate release, than have actually been released in the past, I believe, 10 years or so, which just speaks to the just dysfunction of the current system. And so our hope is that people can be safely and humanely released to get the care that they need at home with loved ones instead of remaining in prison. I mean, I think that's the overarching goal of the bill. To distill it down into what it actually does, it'll create an independent medical review committee that'll make recommendations to the Board of Parole or the sentencing court solely and objectively from a medical and public health perspective. And so if the committee recommends release, the sentencing court or the Board of Parole can either affirm or deny release. And there's some additional pieces to that, but it's a presumptive release, right? So the presumption is that if this Medical Release Advisory Committee, also known as MRAC, recommends release, then the Board of Parole or the sentencing court really do have to show that there's some public safety reason to not release an individual, and they have a standard that they need to meet. And so that's really the crux of what the bill does. And it's, again, it's the real idea is to have medical professionals making medical decisions and analysis and recommendations, which seems logical, at least to me. And so we know that prisons are not set up to provide a dignified or peaceful environment for someone who's in the end stages of life, despite DOCs and the hospice volunteers' best efforts to support them. And so we know, and we've heard from individuals, that they would be better off at home with their families than in prison. And I think that's really the goal. And I do want to share one quote that I've heard from, I mentioned Anthony Pickens when talking about SB 579. And just a quote, he was incarcerated in Oregon and he was a hospice volunteer. And I just wanted to, if I can, share one quote. The quote is, one of the guys that I was on vigil with, he couldn't talk, he couldn't walk, he couldn't do anything on his own. So us hospice volunteers would clean him up, change his adult diapers, and we would wheel him into the shower. The most he could do during any given time was moan. And I think that this really sums up some of the population that are currently incarcerated that really should not be incarcerated. And we have to go back to having some compassion. And I think we took a step forward on this with a prison visit to Oregon State Penitentiary that we organized with Senator Dembro's office to get legislators to go into Oregon State Penitentiary and see the infirmary and talk with hospice volunteers. And I think it had a profound effect. I think we were able to have Kyle Hedquist, who's another one of our staff members on our policy team, who actually founded or helped, was there at the founding of the hospice volunteers program at Oregon State Penitentiary. He was incarcerated at that time and was a volunteer. And so he was able to really speak to how it has evolved and all of the shortcomings of it. And I think one of the big takeaways was seeing walkers and wheelchairs just outside of every single cell, you know, in the infirmary and towards the hospice unit. So, you know, our hope is to really raise awareness about this population and hopefully pass the bill this session. The bill does come with a large fiscal, but it also comes with a large savings. And the issue in Oregon is oftentimes the fiscal that gets presented to lawmakers doesn't include the savings aspect of it. And so it's on the advocates to make sure that legislators, while they see a big fiscal, they also see that there's going to be savings on this. Senator Dembro was on a task force for corrections health, and they made a lot of recommendations. And one of the recommendations was to implement this new compassionate release process, and then to use those savings to help fund some of the other recommendations. And so I think that's really where we can see some significant savings.
A third bill that you're working on is Justice for Survivor Defendants. And this one does not have a bill attached to it yet.
Correct. It doesn't have a bill number. It has what's called an LC or legislative concept number 3918. And it should have a bill number in the next few weeks, sometime before the middle of February or late February. So this bill is, again, another one that we're bringing back. We didn't bring it in 2022, but we did introduce it in 2021. And then Representative Anna Williams championed the bill. This time around, this session, Senator Campos is going to be introducing the bill. And we've been working with her on that. And so again, this bill is, you know, trying to help a specific population. We know numerous studies going back many years have observed high rates of victimization among female criminal defendants and linked domestic abuse in their lives to the commission of their crimes. It used to be called, you know, battered women syndrome, and it's evolved into more understanding of what the actual connection is and what's going on. And so people in abusive relationships may be involved in crimes for a variety of reasons. They may be threatened or coerced by their abuser, or they may be trying to protect themselves or their children from the abuser. They may be trying to fight back or escape their partner, or they may be blamed for their abuser's actions, which we've seen happen. And so Oregon's failing this group. We know that, and that's why we brought in 21, and that's why we're going to bring it back this session. And we call them survivor defendants. They are survivors. They are also defendants. And we have to be able to hold those two truths. Currently, our sentencing laws do not adequately consider the histories of victimization for these individuals, or the role that domestic violence has played in the commission of their crimes, to make a fair assessment of their culpability. And so oftentimes we see, and this is in large part due to Measure 11, our mandatory minimum laws in Oregon, some of the worst in the country, by the way, it's another conversation. They are often sentenced to excessive terms of incarceration that are grossly disproportionate to their role and intent in the criminalized activity. And then we see just further victimization because they're at a high risk of further trauma in prison. And so essentially what this bill does, it requires the courts to consider evidence of domestic violence when they are sentencing someone. So the court will have discretion to impose a lesser sentence on a survivor defendant when the presumptive or mandatory sentence, so generally Measure 11 sentence, would be too harsh under the circumstances. And then also addressing kind of that the re-traumatization and further trauma in prison, the bill would also create a task force to make recommendations regarding programs and services that are needed in Department of Corrections to make sure that survivors leave prison healthy and safely and prevent further re-traumatization of those incarcerated individuals, survivors, in prison. So that's kind of the crux of the bill. You know, it can really even be distilled down further into providing a judge discretion. When we hear opposition around this bill, oftentimes, anytime you give judges more discretion and prosecutors less discretion, we can oftentimes guess that there's going to be some opposition from the district attorneys. You know, I think oftentimes we hear district attorneys say that they already consider this in plea bargaining and they already consider this in their charging decisions and in making their sentencing recommendations. I think that we've heard from numerous survivors who've been incarcerated that it was not taken into account and that we are not willing to just take the district attorneys at their word because it can also change from district attorney could change from case to case. It allows the ability to bring in bias by the district attorneys, implicit or explicit bias. And so it's not okay for us just to rely on district attorneys to, you know, to do the right thing in this case. And so we really do want to provide the court with the option to depart out of a disproportionate sentence. And this is one reason we're saying justice for all survivors, right? Because whether you're a defendant or not, you're also a survivor. You've been subjected to an abusive relationship. And it's important that we be able to lift up this population and make sure that they're getting the treatment and the attention that they deserve and not allow the system to just continue to over-incarcerate.
And what about those who have been convicted and are serving time?
Yeah, so there is a mechanism that would allow for those who didn't have an opportunity to present evidence of the domestic violence to petition for review. The concern that we always have is if we're going to make a fix going forward, we also want to provide an avenue for individuals who weren't able to avail themselves of this new law to go back and ask the court to consider this. And so it's similar criteria, but it is petitioning the court to essentially go back and review the case.
And I understand an Oregon Justice Resource Center attorney that the woman, especially in Coffee Creek, Oregon's only women's prison, they began telling her their stories. Whether it made a difference or not, they wanted someone to hear why they ended up committing a crime. So can you talk about that and talk about some of the statistics, especially with the women incarcerated in Coffee Creek?
There's always a concern about re-traumatization, right? If someone telling their story and whether that results in further trauma. But I think what we found, our Women's Justice Project, which is a project within the Oregon Justice Resource Center led by Julia Yoshimoto, who's the attorney and director, she definitely had many individuals share their stories with her about being survivor defendants. And that's where this bill comes out of. This bill comes out of a survey, her story survey, that surveyed more than 140 women who were incarcerated at Coffee Creek. And it took place in 2017 to 2018 and discovered that 65% of the women in a relationship at the time of arrest reported experiencing abuse in their relationship. 60% reported physical violence, 62% reported threats of harm, and 79% reported verbal abuse. We also found that 44% of the women in a relationship at the time of arrest said the relationship contributed to their conviction. And again, 44% of the women in a relationship at the time of the arrest said they were afraid of their partner. And I think that, you know, the data bears out what Julia has heard anecdotally from mostly women, because that's the population that she's working with, that this is a significant issue and it's something that needs to be addressed. And one of the reasons that we continue to push for it, also one of the reasons that we on this bill have said that we are keeping Measure 11 in terms of we are trying to, with bills, trying to not complicate this, but Measure 10 and Measure 11 work together to force essentially 2/3 majority vote in both chambers to pass a bill that, let's just say, impacts Measure 11. Pierces Measure 11 is another way to put it, but that involves Measure 11 and reducing, because the judges have the ability to depart out of a Measure 11 sentence, it's considered impacting Measure 11. So this bill will require a 2/3 vote in both chambers to pass. And I think that oftentimes that causes people to remove Measure 11, people serving Measure 11 sentences from their bills, which was the intent of Measure 10 and Measure 11 back in 94, 95. But because of Julia's advocacy and work with this population, OJRC knows that we absolutely need to keep the Measure 11 piece in there. And so we know it's an uphill battle, but we also know that it is values-wise, it is absolutely the right decision to keep it in.
And how can people get involved
Yeah, there'll definitely be more information on our website coming up. And so checking in on our website, ojrc.info, and following us at Twitter and Instagram at OJR Center, and then on Facebook, because we're going to be creating a separate website landing page for this bill that'll provide a lot of information. And so we're really looking forward to that. And so checking in on social media and our website for when that comes out, there'll also be signing up for our newsletter and just any email blasts that we send out to keep updated on it. And so then what we'll be doing is using those tools and that website to really keep individuals who want to be involved updated on what's going on, and then to provide information on when public hearings are scheduled and work sessions are scheduled and how they can contact their legislators.
And they can actually track the bill through OregonLegislature.gov. And our legislators really need to hear from us on these issues. So, Zach, what other bills or legislation are in the works right now that OGRC is following?
I'll cover two other bills and then just one other caveat, which is, I call it another bill, but it's really just a task of ours to fight off what I call bad bills. But we have HB 2327, so House Bill 2327, which is establishing a minimum age of prosecution. Oregon currently has no legal minimum age at which a child may be prosecuted. And so HB 2327 would establish a minimum age of prosecution of 12 and bring Oregon in line with 24 other states that have established a minimum age at which youth can be prosecuted. And so we believe that we have to protect our children against the harms of the juvenile justice involvement and to allow them to access supportive services and resources. And so that's kind of two parts of the bill. It sets a minimum age and also provides funding for the children that previously could have been prosecuted but are not going to be prosecuted by having a minimum age. And I think that OJRC absolutely believes that the age should be 14. But we are with the coalition on this bill, and we have been very clear that if we're going to the age of 12, there should be no carve-outs, meaning it shouldn't be a minimum age of 12 unless you're charged with, and then a list of crimes being carve-outs. And so we've been very clear about that. And so we'll see where, you know, what happens with this bill, but we are supportive of it. We're in a coalition. It's an interesting coalition, a great coalition. The Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, ACLU Oregon, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Disability Rights Oregon, and Youth Rights and Justice. So it's really a broad spectrum group that is in support of this bill. And I think opposition-wise, you probably won't be surprised to hear that the district attorneys have expressed concerns with setting a minimum age for prosecution. And yet, I hope to many that it is a pretty reasonable statement that we do not want to incarcerate children. We do not want to prosecute children. There is an inherent, I think, undercurrent in the U.S. that the way to address wrongs is to punish, is to set an example. And especially with this population of children who are under 12, there are better systems and better ways to hold individuals, children accountable than to prosecute and bring them into the juvenile justice system. And I think that we're really happy with, you know, our partners at the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association see this and want to provide services outside of prosecution for this population. I think the other one I would highlight is, we don't have a bill number yet for it as well. It's LC 964, and we're calling it Expedited Judicial Review for Conditions of Confinement Cases. And so the concept for this bill was originally discussed in the recommendation section of OJRC's report, ODOC, An Agency in Crisis, which was put together by our investigative researcher, Justin Lowe. And so just for listeners, the report and other reports, our other reports, can be found at ojrc.info/reports, R-E-P-O-R-T-S. And so this bill came out of a recommendation that Justin had put in there. And so when a person is in custody of ODOC and is subject to excessive or inappropriate punishment that may violate their constitutional rights, there's not currently an opportunity to contest that action in a meaningful or efficient way. The way to address that is to file a lawsuit that takes years to litigate. And so adults in custody cannot petition state courts to review disciplinary orders imposed by ODOC, and other review options are inadequate, right? So grievance options, filing a federal lawsuit, a potential habeas suit, these are all difficult and timely and take up a ton of time to actually get resolved. And so what this bill does is it will allow individuals to access state courts for an expedited process of judicial review. And so the idea behind here is really to say, if the Department of Corrections is going to hold someone in what's called choose whatever name you want from ODOC, from the Department of Corrections, solitary confinement, restrictive housing, special housing. The name changes a lot, but all of the above. If a disciplinary order requires someone to spend more than 15 consecutive days in special housing, restrictive housing, or solitary confinement, then the adult in custody can, under this bill, file a petition for review of that order. And so that's really the key for us, is to allow for individuals to actually have meaningful review, so that they're not, if they get 120 days in solitary confinement and they want to file a lawsuit, they're out of solitary confinement before the complaint's even filed. And so here the idea is that if someone's getting 120 days in solitary confinement, they can actually petition the court for review of that disciplinary action. So trying to hold DOC accountable for their disciplinary orders and actions that they're taking. I think the other thing is just to flag for everyone that, you know, one thing that we do, and depending on capacity, it varies in how effective we are, I am, at this, which is to identify bills that we believe will harm efforts to reform the criminal legal system. So there are many, over 4,000 bills were filed this past session, and they're not all criminal legal system related bills, but there are many bills that are filed and introduced that we believe do more harm than good for the criminal legal system. And so one of our responsibilities is to connect with partners, community partners, identifying those bills, educating legislators on or advocating against those bills, checking in on our website. You will start seeing when we do put out social media posts on bills that we believe the community should take notice of and potentially testify against.
I've been speaking with Zach Winston, Policy Director with Oregon Justice Resource Center. Thank you so much, Zach.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you to our engineer, and thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information